Reuben Arnold's closing arguments. Mr. Arnold for the prisoner. Quote, "Gentlemen of the jury, we are all to be congratulated that this case is drawing to a close. We have all suffered here from trying a long and complicated case at the heated term of the year. It has been a case that has taken so much effort and so much concentration and so much time, and the quarters here are so poor, that it has been particularly hard on you members of the jury who are practically in custody while the case is going on. I know it's hard on a jury to be kept confined this way, but it is necessary that they be segregated and set apart, where they will get no impression at home nor on the street. The members of the jury are in a sense set apart on a mountain, where, far removed from the passion and heat of the plain, calmness rules them, and they can judge a case on its merits." My friend Hooper said a funny thing here a while ago. I don't think he meant what he said, however. Mr. Hooper said that the men in the jury box are not different from the men on the street. Your Honor, I'm learning something every day, and I certainly learned something today, if that's true. End quote. Mr. Hooper. Quote, Mr. Arnold evidently mistakes my meaning, which I thought I made clear. I stated that the men in the jury box were like they would be on the street in the fact that in making up their minds about the guilt or innocence of the accused, they must use the same common sense that they would if they were not part of the court. End quote. Mr. Arnold. Mr. Arnold next described the horrible crime that had been committed that afternoon or night in the National Pencil Company's dark basement. He dwelt on the effect of the crime upon the people of Atlanta, and of how high feeling ran and still runs, and of the omnipresent desire for the death of the man who committed the crime. Quote, "There are fellows like that streetcar man, Kendley, the one who vilified this defendant here and cried for him to be lynched, and shouted that he was guilty until he made himself a nuisance on the cars he ran. Why, I can hardly realize that a man holding a position as responsible as that of a motorman, and a man with certain police powers, and the discretion necessary to guide a car through the crowded city streets, would give way to passion and prejudice like that. It was a type of man like Kendley who said he did not know for sure whether those Negroes hanged in Decatur for the shooting of the streetcar men were guilty, but he was glad they were hung, as some Negroes ought to be hanged for the crime. He's the same sort of a man who believes that there ought to be a hanging because that innocent little girl was murdered, and who would like to see this Jew here hang because somebody ought to hang for it. I'll tell you right now, if Frank hadn't been a Jew, there would never have been any prosecution against him. I'm asking my own people to turn him loose, asking them to do justice to a Jew. And I'm not a Jew, but I would rather die before doing injustice to a Jew. This case has just been built up by degrees. They have a monstrous perjurer here in the form of this Jim Conley against Frank. You know what sort of a man Conley is, and you know that up to the time the murder was committed, no one ever heard a word against Frank. Villainy like this charged to him does not crop out in a day. There are long mutterings of it for years before. There are only a few who have ever said anything against Frank. I want to call your attention later to the class of their witnesses and the class of ours." A few floaters around the factory, out of the hundreds who have worked there in the plant 3 or 4 years, have been induced to come up here and swear that Frank has not a good character. But the decent employees down there have sworn to his good character. Look at the jailbirds they brought up here, the very dregs of humanity, men and women who have disgraced themselves and who now have come and tried to swear away the life of an innocent man. I know that you members of the jury are impartial. That's the only reason why you are here, and I'm going to strip the state's case bare for you, if I have the strength to last to do it. They have got to show Frank guilty of one thing before you can convict him. They've got to show that he is guilty of the murder, no matter what else they show about him. You are trying him solely for the murder, and there must be no chance that anyone else could just as likely be guilty. If the jury sees that there is just as good a chance that Conley can be guilty, then they must turn Frank loose. Now, you can see how in this case the detectives were put to it to lay the crime on somebody. First, it was Lee, and then it was Gant, and various people came in and declared they had seen the girl alive late Saturday night and at other times, and no one knew what to do. Well, suspicion turned away from Gant, and in a little while it turned away from Lee. Now, I don't believe that Lee is guilty of the crime, but I do believe that he knows a lot more about the crime than he told. He knows about those letters, and he found that body a lot sooner than he said he did. Oh, well, the whole case is a mystery, a deep mystery, but there is one thing pretty plain, and that is that whoever wrote those notes committed the crime. Those notes certainly had some connection with the murder, and whoever wrote those notes committed the crime. Well, they put Newt Lee through the third degree, and the fourth degree, and maybe a few others. That's the way, you know, they got this affidavit from the poor Negro woman, Manola McKnight. Why, just the other day, the Supreme Court handed down a decision in which it referred to the third degree methods of the police and detectives in words that burned. Well, they used those methods with Jim Conley. My friend, Hooper, said nothing held Conley to the witness chair here but the truth. But I tell you that the fear of a broken neck held him there. I think this decision about the third degree was handed down with Conley's case in mind. I'm going to show this Conley business up before I get through. I'm going to show that this entire case is the greatest frame-up in the history of the state. My friend Hooper remarked something about circumstantial evidence and how powerful it frequently was. He forgot to say that the circumstances, in every case, must invariably be proved by witnesses. History contains a long record of circumstantial evidence, and I once had a book on the subject which dwelt on such cases, most of all which sickens the man who reads them. Horrible mistakes have been made by circumstantial evidence, more so than by any other kind. End quote. Here, Mr. Arnold cited the Durant case in San Francisco, the Hampton case in England, and the Dreyfus case in France, as instances of mistakes of circumstantial evidence. In the Dreyfus case, he declared it was purely persecution of the Jew. The hideousness of the murder itself was not as savage, he asserted, as the feeling to convict this man. But the savagery and venom is there just the same, and it is a case very much on the order of Dreyfus. Quote, Hooper says, suppose Frank didn't kill the girl, and Jim Conley did, wasn't it Frank's duty to protect her? He was taking the position that if Jim went back there and killed her, Frank could not help but know about the murder. Which position, I think, is quite absurd. Take this hypothesis, then, of Mr. Hooper's. If Jim saw the girl go up and went back and killed her, would he have taken the body down the elevator at that time? Wouldn't he have waited until Frank and White and Denham and Mrs. White and all others were out of the building? I think so. But there's not a possibility of the girl having been killed on the second floor. Hooper smells a plot and says Frank has his eye on the little girl who was killed. The crime isn't an act of a civilized man. It's the crime of a cannibal, a man-eater. Hooper is hard-pressed and wants to get up a plot. He sees he has to get up something. He forms his plot from Jim Conley's story. They say that on Friday, Frank knew he was going to make an attack of some sort on Mary Fagan. The plot thickens. Of all the wild things I have ever heard, that is the wildest. It is ridiculous. Mary Fagan worked in the pencil factory for months, and all the evidence they have produced that Frank ever associated with her, ever knew her, is the story of weaselly little Willie Turner, who can't even describe the little girl who was killed. A little further on in his story, Jim is beginning the plot. They used him to corroborate everything as they advised. Jim is laying the foundation for the plot. What is it, this plot? Only that on Friday, Frank was planning to commit some kind of assault upon Mary Fagan. Jim was their tool. Even Scott swears that when he told Jim that Jim's story didn't fit, Jim very obligingly adapted it to suit his defense. He was scrupulous about things like that. He was quite considerate. Certainly. He had his own neck to save. Jim undertook to show that Frank had an engagement with some woman at the pencil factory that Saturday morning. There is no pretense that another woman is mixed up in the case. No one would argue that he planned to meet and assault this innocent little girl who was killed. Who but God would know whether she was coming for her pay that Friday afternoon or the next Saturday? Are we stark idiots? Can't we divine some things? They've got a girl named Ferguson who says she went for Mary Fagan's pay on the Friday before she was killed, and that Frank wouldn't give it to her. It is the wildest theory on earth, and it fits nothing. It is a strained conspiracy. Frank, to show you I am correct, had nothing whatever to do with paying off on Friday. Schiff did it all. And little Magnolia Kennedy, Helen Ferguson's best friend, says she was with Helen when Helen went to draw her pay, and that Helen never said a word about Mary's envelope. There's your conspiracy, with Jim Conley's story as its foundation. It's too thin. It's preposterous. Then my friend Hooper says Frank discharged Gant because he saw Gant talking to Mary Fagan. If you convict men on such distorted evidence as this, why, you'd be hanging men perpetually. Gant, in the first place, doesn't come into this case in any good light. It is ridiculously absurd to bring his discharge into this plot of the defense. Why, even Grace Hicks, who worked with Mary Fagan, and who is a sister-in-law of Boots Rogers, says that Frank did not know the little girl. Hooper also says that bad things are going on in the pencil factory, and that it is natural for men to cast about for girls in such environments. We are not trying this case on whether you or I or Frank had been perfect in the past. This is a case of murder. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. I say this much, and that is that there has been as little evidence of such conditions in this plant as any other of its kind you can find in the city. They have produced some, of course, but it is an easy matter to locate some 10 or 12 disgruntled ex-employees who are vengeful enough to swear against their former superintendent, even though they don't know him except by sight. I want to ask this much. Could Frank have remained at the head of this concern if he had been as loose morally as the state has striven to show? If he had carried on with the girls of the place, as my friend alleged, wouldn't the entire working force have been demoralized, ruined? He may have looked into this dressing room, as the little Jackson girl says, but if he did, it was done to see that the girls weren't loitering. There were no lavatories, no toilets, no baths in these dressing rooms. The girls only changed their top garments. He wouldn't have seen much if he had peered into the place. You can go to Piedmont Park any day and see girls and women with a whole lot less on their persons. And to the shows any night you can see the actresses with almost nothing on. Everything brought against Frank was some act he did openly and in broad daylight, and an act against which no kick was made. The trouble with Hooper is that he sees a bear in every bush. He sees a plot in this because Frank told Jim Conley to come back Saturday morning. The office that day was filled with persons throughout the day. How could he know when Mary Fagan was coming or how many persons would be in the place when she arrived? This crime is the hideous act of a Negro who would ravish a 10-year-old girl the same as he would ravish a woman of years. It isn't a white man's crime. It's the crime of a beast. A low, savage beast. Now, back to the case. There is an explorer in the pencil factory by the name of Barrett. I call him Christopher Columbus Barrett, purely for his penchant for finding things. Mr. Barrett discovered the blood spots in the place where Chief Beavers, Chief Lanford, and Mr. Black and Mr. Starnes had searched on the Sunday of the discovery. They found nothing of the sort. Barrett discovered the stains after he had proclaimed to the whole second floor that he was going to get the $4,000 reward if Mr. Frank was convicted. Now you talk about plants. If this doesn't look mighty funny, that a man expecting a reward would find blood spots in a place that has been scoured by detectives, I don't know what does. Four chips of this flooring were chiseled from this flooring where these spots were found. The floor was an inch deep in dirt and grease. Victims of accidents had passed by the spot with bleeding fingers and hands. If a drop of blood had ever fallen there, a chemist could find it 4 years later. Their contention is that all the big spots were undiluted blood. Yet, let's see how much blood Dr. Claude Smith found on the chips. Probably 5 corpuscles. That's all. And that's what he testified here at the trial. My recollection is that one single drop of blood contains 8,000 corpuscles. And he found these corpuscles on only one chip. I say that half of the blood had been on the floor 2 or 3 years. The stain on all chips but one were not blood. Dorsey's own doctors have put him where he can't wriggle. His own evidence hampers him. They found blood spots on a certain spot and then had Jim adapt his story accordingly. They had him put the finding of the body near the blood spots and had him drop it right where the spots were found. It stands to reason that if a girl had been wounded on the lathing machine, there would have been blood in the vicinity of the machine. Yet, there was no blood in that place, and neither was there any where the body was said to have been found by Conley. The case doesn't fit. It's flimsy. And this white machine oil that they've raised such a rumpus over. It was put on the floor as a cheap, common plant to make it appear as though someone had put it there in an effort to hide the blood spots. The 2 spots of blood and the strands of hair are the only evidence that the prosecution has that the girl was killed on the second floor. Now, about these strands of hair. Barrett, the explorer, says he found 4 or 5 strands on the lathing machine. I don't know whether he did or not. They've never been produced. I've never seen them. But it's probable, for just beyond the lathing machine, right in the path of a draft that blows in from the window, is a gas jet used by the girls in curling and primping their hair. It's very probable that strands of hair have been blown from this jet to the lathing machine. The detectives say that Frank is a crafty, cunning criminal, when, deep down in their heart of hearts, they know good and well that their case is built against him purely because he was honest enough to admit having seen her that day. Had he been a criminal, he never would have told about seeing her and would have replaced her envelope in the desk, saying she had never called for her pay. I believe that a majority of women are good. The state jumped on poor Daisy Hopkins. I don't contend, now, mind you, that she is a paragon of virtue. But there are men who were put up by the state who are no better than she. For instance, this Dalton, who says openly that he went into the basement with Daisy. I don't believe he ever did, but in such a case, he slipped in. There are some fallen women who can tell the truth. They have characteristics like all other types. We put her on the stand to prove Dalton a liar, and she did it. Now, gentlemen, don't you think the prosecution is hard-pressed when they put up such a character as Dalton? They say he has reformed. A man with thievery in his soul never reforms. Drunkards do, and men with bad habits, but thieves? No. Would you convict a man like Frank on the word of a perjurer like Dalton? Now I'm coming back to Jim Conley. The whole case centers around him. Mr. Hooper argues well on that part. At the outset of the case, the suspicion pointed to Frank merely because he was the only man in the building. It never cropped out for weeks that anyone else was on the first floor. The detectives put their efforts on Frank because he admitted having seen the girl. They have let their zeal run away with them in this case, and it is tragic. They are proud whenever they get a prisoner who will tell something. The humbler the victim, the worse is the case. Such evidence comes with the stamp of untruth on its face. Jim Conley was telling his story to save his neck, and the detectives were happy listeners. If there is one thing for which a Negro is capable, it is for telling a story in detail. It is the same with children. Both have vivid imaginations. And a Negro is also the best mimic in the world. He can imitate anybody. Jim Conley, as he lay in his cell and read the papers and talked with the detectives, conjured up his wonderful story and laid the crime on Frank because the detectives had laid it there and were helping him do the same. Now Brother Hooper waves the bloody shirt in our face. It was found Monday or Tuesday in Newt Lee's house, while Detectives Black and Scott were giving cane to poor old man Newt Lee. I don't doubt for a minute that they knew it was out there when they started out after it. I can't say they planted it, but it does look suspicious. Don't ask us about a planted shirt. Ask Scott and Black. The first thing that points to Conley's guilt is his original denial that he could write. Why did he deny it? Why? I don't suppose much was thought of it when Jim said he couldn't write, because there are plenty of Negroes who are in the same fix. But later, when they found he could, and found that his script compared perfectly with the murder notes, they went right on accusing Frank. Not in criminal annals was there a better chance to lay at the door of another man a crime than Jim Conley had. You see, there is a reason to all things. The detective department had many reasons to push the case against Frank. He was a man of position and culture. They were afraid that someone, unless they pushed the case to the jumping-off place, would accuse them of trying to shield him. They are afraid of public and sentiment and do not want to combat it. So, in such cases, they invariably follow the line of least resistance. You've been listening to our continuing audiobook series featuring the best writing from the American Mercury on the Leo Frank case. Be with us next time when we'll continue with the next installment of the American Mercury on Leo Frank.